Thump again, and be ready. She's here. I began to thump furiously, and Don Juan put his foot over mine and signaled me frantically to relax and thump rhythmically. "Don't scare her away," he whispered in my ear. "Calm down, and don't lose your marbles." He again began to mark the pace of my thumping, and after the second time he made me stop, I heard the same cry again. This time it seemed to be the cry of a bird which was flying over the hill. Don Juan made me thump once more, and just when I stopped, I heard a peculiar rustling sound to my left. It was the sound a heavy animal would make while moving about in the dry underbrush. The thought of a bear crossed my mind, but then I realized there were no such bears in the desert. I grabbed on to Don Juan's arm, and he smiled at me and put his finger to his mouth in a gesture of silence. I stared into the darkness towards my left, but he signaled me not to. He repeatedly pointed directly above me, and then he made me turn around slowly and silently until I was facing the dark mass of the hill. Don Juan kept his finger leveled at a certain point on the hill. I kept my eyes glued to the spot, and suddenly, as if in a nightmare, a dark shadow leaped at me. I shrieked and fell down to the ground on my back. For a moment, the dark silhouette was superimposed against the dark blue sky, and then it sailed through the air and landed beyond us in the bushes. I heard the sound of a heavy body crashing into the shrubs, and then an eerie outcry. Don Juan helped me up and guided me in the darkness to the place where I'd left my traps. He made me gather and disassemble them, and then he scattered the pieces away in all directions. He performed all this without saying a single word. We didn't speak at all on our way back to his house.
"What do you want me to say?"
Don Juan asked, after I had urged him repeatedly to explain the events I had witnessed a few hours before.
"What was it?" I asked. "You know damn well who it was," he said. "Don't water it down with what was it. It's who it was that's important."
I had worked out an explanation that seemed to suit me. The figure I had seen looked very much like a kite that someone had let out over the hill while someone else, behind us, had pulled it to the ground, thus the effect of a dark silhouette sailing through the air perhaps 15 or 20 yards. He listened attentively to my explanation and then laughed until tears rolled down his cheeks.
"Quit beating around the bush," he said. "Get to the point. Wasn't it a woman?"
I had to admit that when I fell down and looked up, I saw the dark silhouette of a woman with a long skirt leaping over me in a very slow motion. Then something seemed to have pulled the dark silhouette, and it flew over me with great speed and crashed into the bushes. In fact, that movement was what had given me the idea of a kite. Don Juan refused to discuss the incident any further. The next day, he left to fulfill some mysterious errand, and I went to visit some Yaqui friends in another community. Wednesday, December 12, 1962. As soon as I arrived at the Yaqui community, the Mexican storekeeper told me that he had rented a record player and 20 records from an outfit in Ciudad Obregón for the fiesta he was planning to give that night in honor of the Virgin of Guadalupe. He'd already told everybody that he'd made all the necessary arrangements through Julio, the traveling salesman who came to the Yaqui settlement twice a month to collect installments on a layaway plan for cheap articles of clothing, which he had succeeded in selling to some Yaqui Indians. Julio brought the record player early in the afternoon and hooked it to the dynamo that provided electricity for the store. He made sure that it worked, then he turned up the volume to its maximum, reminded the storekeeper not to touch any knobs, and began to sort the 20 records.
"I know how many scratches each of them has," Julio said to the storekeeper. Tell that to my daughter, the storekeeper replied. You're responsible, not your daughter.
Well, just the same, she's the only one who'll be changing the records.
Julio insisted that it didn't make any difference to him whether she or someone else was going to actually handle the record player, as long as the storekeeper paid for any records that were damaged. The storekeeper began to argue with Julio. Julio's face became red. He turned from time to time to the large group of Yaqui Indians congregated in front of the store and made signs of despair or frustration by moving his hands or contorting his face in a grimace. Seemingly, as a final resort, he demanded a cash deposit. That precipitated another long argument about what constituted a damaged record. Julio stated with authority that any broken record had to be paid for in full, as if it were new. The storekeeper became angrier and began to pull out his extension cords. He seemed bent upon unhooking the record player and canceling the party. He made it clear to his clients congregated in front of the store that he'd tried his best to come to terms with Julio. For a moment, it seemed that the party was going to fail before it had started. Blas, the old Yaqui Indian in whose house I was staying, made some derogatory comments in a loud voice about the Yaqui's sad state of affairs, that they couldn't even celebrate their most revered religious festivity, the Day of the Virgin of Guadalupe. I wanted to intervene and offer my help, but Blas stopped me. He said that if I were to make the cash deposit, the storekeeper himself would smash the records. He's worse than anybody, he said. Let him pay the deposit. He bleeds us, so why shouldn't he pay? After a long discussion, in which, strangely enough, everyone present was in favor of Julio, the storekeeper hit upon terms which were mutually agreeable. He didn't pay a cash deposit, but accepted responsibility for the records and the record player. Julio's motorcycle left a trail of dust as he headed for some of the more remote houses in the locality. Blas said that he was trying to get to his customers before they came to the store and spent all their money buying booze. As he was saying this, a group of Indians emerged from behind the store. Blas looked at them and began to laugh, and so did everyone else there. Blas told me that those Indians were Julio's customers and had been hiding behind the store waiting for him to leave. The party began early. The storekeeper's daughter put a record on the turntable and brought the arm down. There was a terrible loud screech and a high-pitched buzz, and then came a blasting sound of trumpet and some guitars. The party consisted of playing the records at full volume. There were four young Mexican men who danced with the storekeeper's two daughters and three other young Mexican women. The Yaquis didn't dance. They watched with apparent delight every movement the dancers made. They seemed to be enjoying themselves, just watching and gulping down cheap tequila. I bought individual drinks for everybody I knew. I wanted to avoid any feelings of resentment. I circulated among the numerous Indians and talked to them and then offered them drinks. My pattern of behavior worked, until they realized I wasn't drinking at all. That seemed to annoy everyone at once. It was as if, collectively, they had discovered that I didn't belong there. The Indians became very gruff and gave me sly looks. The Mexicans, who were as drunk as the Indians, also realized at the same time that I hadn't danced, and that appeared to offend them even more. They became very aggressive. One of them forcibly took me by the arm and dragged me closer to the record player. Another served me a full cup of tequila and wanted me to drink it all in one gulp and prove that I was a macho. I tried to stall them and laughed idiotically, as if I were actually enjoying the situation. I said that I would like to dance first and then drink. One of the young men called out the name of a song. The girl in charge of the record player began to search in the pile of records. She seemed to be a little tipsy, although none of the women had openly been drinking, and had trouble fitting a record on the turntable. A young man said that the record she'd selected wasn't a twist. She fumbled with the pile, trying to find the suitable one, and everyone closed in around her and left me.
That gave me time to run behind the store, away from the lighted area, and out of sight. I stood about 30 yards away, in the darkness of some bushes, trying to decide what to do. I was tired. I felt it was time to get in my car and go back home. I began to walk to Blas's house, where my car was parked. I figured that if I drove slowly, no one would notice that I was leaving. The people in charge of the record player were apparently still looking for the record. All I could hear was the high-pitched buzzing of the loudspeaker. But then came the blasting sound of a twist. I laughed out loud, thinking that they'd probably turn to where I'd been and found out that I'd disappeared. I saw some dark silhouettes of people walking in the opposite direction, going towards the store. We passed each other, and they mumbled, "Buenas noches." I recognized them and spoke to them. I told them it was a great party. Before I came to a sharp bend in the road, I encountered two other people, whom I didn't recognize, but I greeted them anyway. The blasting sound of the record player was almost as loud there on the road as it was in front of the store. It was a dark, starless night, but the glare from the store lights allowed me to have a fairly good visual perception of my surroundings. Blas's house was very near, and I accelerated my pace. I noticed then the dark shape of a person, sitting, or perhaps squatting, to my left, at the bend of the road. I thought for an instant that it might have been one of the people from the party who had left before I had. The person seemed to be defecating on the side of the road. That seemed odd. People in the community went into the thick bushes to perform their bodily functions. I thought that whoever it was in front of me must have been drunk. I came to the bend and said, "Buenas noches." The person answered me with an eerie, gruff, inhuman howl. The hair on my body literally stood on end. For a second, I was paralyzed. Then I began to walk fast. I took a quick glance. I saw that the dark silhouette had stood up halfway. It was a woman. She was stooped over, leaning forward. She walked in that position for a few yards, and then she hopped. I began to run, while the woman hopped like a bird by my side, keeping up with my speed. By the time I arrived at Blas's house, she was cutting in front of me, and we'd almost touched. I leaped across a small, dry ditch in front of the house and crashed through the flimsy door. Blas was already in the house and seemed unconcerned with my story. "They pulled a good one on you," he said reassuringly. "The Indians take delight in teasing foreigners." My experience had been so unnerving that the next day I drove to Don Juan's house instead of going home as I'd planned to do. Don Juan returned in the late afternoon. I didn't give him time to say anything, but blurted out the whole story, including Blas's commentary. Don Juan's face became somber. Perhaps it was only my imagination, but I thought he was worried. "Don't put so much stock in what Blas told you," he said in a serious tone. "He knows nothing of the struggles between sorcerers. You should have known that it was something serious the moment you noticed that the shadow was to your left. You shouldn't have run, either." "What was I supposed to do? Stand there?" "Right. When a warrior encounters his opponent, and the opponent is not an ordinary human being, he must make his stand. That's the only thing that makes him invulnerable."
"What are you saying, Don Juan?"
"I'm saying that you've had your third encounter with your worthy opponent. She's following you around, waiting for a moment of weakness on your part. She almost bagged you this time." I felt a surge of anxiety and accused him of putting me in unnecessary danger. I complained that the game he was playing with me was cruel. "It would be cruel if this would have happened to an average man," he said. "But the instant one begins to live like a warrior, one is no longer ordinary. Besides, I didn't find you a worthy opponent because I want to play with you or tease you or annoy you. A worthy opponent